All right. It has been years in the making, and we finally got the man, the myth, the legend, Taylor Welch on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, man.
I'm sorry that the team made you wait so long. I didn't know that. I would have sped it up, but here we are.
All good, man. God has some awesome timing because we create that momentum right into going skiing with you in Colorado. Oh, so yeah. We're super excited about that, man.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait. It's good to be here.
Yes, sir. So on this podcast, we want everyone that's listened to this podcast already knows who you are. We talk about you all the time. If you don't know Taylor, get out from living under a rock, go watch his content, get into his ecosystem. We want to go super tactical with the time that we have. And Taylor is the master at consulting and scaling consulting brands, not just scaling them quickly, but healthily, which is more important at the same time. So I'd love to go into a little bit more of your story when you're of like your transition from the large agency model to the smaller, leaner, profitable model. And then we can kind of riff from there if you're open to it.
Yeah, sounds great, man. So I took my first couple of clients in 2015 and I booked out my entire calendar. You know, doing agency like service work, we talk about there's four main ways you can monetize. This is as tactical as you can get. You have products, which are like books and courses, things that are typically and traditionally low ticket. You have programs, which would be experiences. In 2015, programs were like brand new. Nobody really had a program. Sam Ovens had a program. Russ Ruffino had a program, but they were pretty rare. Then you had services and partnerships. Partnerships are like, you know, JVs and affiliates, things like that. And just people like Pat Flynn were monetizing hundreds of thousands of dollars a month just from referring, recommending things. I was like all in on services. I was doing all of the work for people. There's no leverage though in services. And so a guy named Sam Ovens messaged me on Facebook and he was like, hey, you should work with me and you'll make more money. I was like, okay, I've never heard of this guy, but I was like, cool. So let's do it. I sent him $5,500 and he sent me a Dropbox folder. That was his program. And he's like, go through all of this. We're probably like we had to have been like his first 10 or 15 clients. I don't know, but this was way back in the day. And Sam looked at our model and he looked at all that I was doing. And he said, you can't take any more done for you clients. I was like, well, that's all my clients. I don't know exactly what to do. He's like, just put some training together. And, cause I had people messaging me like, how are you booked out on clients? I had a 12-month waiting list. And I was just teaching them for free. I was telling them what I was doing. You know, you guys probably get this all the time. Somebody will message you, hey, what do you do when this happens? And I was just messaging people back, telling them what to do. So I put that all in a program and I started charging for it. I think $3,000 was the first price. And I enrolled four or five people in that, then 5K, then 7K, then 10K, all the way up to like now we have $150,000 programs that people can hop into for engagement. So my like transition point was really fast. And it was from, you can call it the summer of 2015 to by the end of 2015, I wasn't doing any service work anymore. I was only doing teaching and training. That parlayed into Traffic and Funnels, which was the first consultancy. That business got really big. Then Sales Mentor, then Intelligent Advertiser. And so really looking back, a very small fraction of my career has been done for you and agency work. I have purchased agencies or partnered into agencies, but I didn't do agency work for more than like 8 months, which is kind of wild when you think about it. So that's kind of how it happened. And it's all Sam's fault. you can blame it on him.
Sure. Okay. So you go into the full-time just training and consulting model. And to my knowledge, based on what I know of you, a lot of it started in like the copywriting space when you were working in real estate. I'd love to know a little bit more about like your IP creation process, because like we read everything you do and because it's good. Like your newsletters, they get better and better. Like what is your process to continue creating the margin to allow yourself to keep fresh new ideas rolling and then transitioning to that to educational products and all that stuff?
Yeah, margin is an interesting topic because margin comes where you force it. And I was literally talking with, there's a copywriter, his name is Nicholas Verge, and he's a really, really good copywriter. And he was
Nick is awesome. Love that dude.
He's great. I mean, he's like 15 years old, but he's phenomenal. I'm like, you're a prodigy. He was like, how do you come up with so much writing and material? And I said, it's super nuanced and super complicated. And here's the secret. I just make myself write 2 hours a day. And if I don't hit 2 hours, I just stay awake until I hit my 2 hours. And he was really disappointed in that answer because it was just super simple. But you go into the back end of it, and I've got there's a great book called Building Your Second Brain by Tiago Fort. And he talks about this philosophy of using like Evernote or Notion to just like, we're in such a digital era. We're overwhelmed and bombarded with content. And most of it's not very good. You've got a few outliers who are phenomenal. And what I've done is I've structured my life. Your outputs are just pretty much equal to your inputs. So the more you read, the more material and fodder, we call it fodder. I literally have an Evernote folder. Speaking of the memos or the digest, I have an Evernote folder called Memo Fodder. And anytime I see something, I'm like, that's a really great thing to teach on. I'll put it in there. And so when I sit down to write, I'm not starting at zero. I'm starting with the bed of ideas that are organized really nicely so that I can just go in and pick up from scratch. There's another good book called Pink Sheets. And Pink Sheets is a kind of a methodology of taking your ideas and turning them into concepts, because not every idea is a concept. Not every piece of content is a model. We can go deep down this rabbit hole if you want tactically, but I learned the difference between models and ideas from Traffic and Funnels. When I stepped away from Traffic and Funnels, it was very obvious that that business didn't run off of models. It ran off of a genius. Most people in consulting are just geniuses. They're not actual builders. Jim Collins calls it, it's the difference between like a genius with 1,000 helpers. And he calls them watchmakers. Like the difference between like a watchmaker, you're building devices that tell time versus being a genius and having a bunch of little VAs running around. And so I try to take anything I'm doing, if I'm doing it more than 10 times, it's got to be turned into a model so that I can teach that to my team. And I spend a lot of time on it and I stress test it. I'll test it with clients. If it works, I'll test it with another client. If it works, I turn it into a model. The secret there, though, is honestly, it's just time. If you don't spend time on it, it's not going to happen. There's really no hack to it. Despite my attempts to find one, 2 hours a day. That's my hack.
That's great. Now, something that came up in my mind as you were finishing up there was Buy Back Your Time, Dave Martell.
Great book.
Our listeners all know that book well and implement it themselves, but how are you implementing that whole concept in your daily practice? What are some things that you found that worked really well? Some things maybe that you didn't implement?
Every month I go through and I review my month. I do this weekly and monthly, but my weekly ones are pretty quick. So I use Notion for this because Notion is like a hierarchy database type thing. And Evernote is my catch-all. So anything I just want to throw into my repository to remember goes into Evernote. But Notion, I have a weekly review and a monthly review. On a monthly basis, I'm looking for three things. Number one, what are the things that I don't want to do anymore? Like I'm not having fun. They would be like a red. They're taking energy from me. Whether it's productive or not, like I just don't like it. The neutral would be like your orange or yellow. I'm just cool with it. Leave it. Don't change anything. And the green is, what are the things that I either didn't do enough of or I want to add to my regimen? And that keeps me on a monthly, kind of a monthly cadence. My schedule is getting cleaned once a month. And it's important to notate that very, very rarely do I have like 100% month. I would change nothing. Like everything was perfect. I have nothing in the red. Because we get lost in if your audience is anything like me, sometimes you just get lost in chaos. You're traveling, you launch a product that doesn't work, you have like an event and it's just chaos. And so on a monthly basis, I really try to zoom back out and cut the things that are not helping me. Dan is a specimen at this. But what's funny about Dan, I've told him this before. I'm like, the Buy Back Your Time guy is like booked from sun up to sun down. It's not that he's like doing he's not just sitting and meditating with all of the time he bought back. What his real methodology is that that buyback loop. It's like, if there's something that you don't like doing, get someone else to do it. And if something gives you energy, do as much of it as you can. So it's I think people get a little too linear about the buyback principle, because they're just like, I'm doing stuff, so I need to buy back my time. No. You should be doing stuff all the time. Like, be as busy as you can, but be busy on things that fill you up and make you happy, you know?
Sure. Yeah, well said. So let's shift gears a little bit to the book, which I believe to be the consulting Bible, in my opinion. I think that this book is going to be so evergreen for so long, and I don't know how you packed in all this value within 100 pages, but really well done. I don't say that because you're on here. That's just the truth. It's a really good book. You talk about this concept of building a moat, and I'd love to dive in a little bit more into the moat, because we're actively like in your moat at the same time, which is really cool. Like, we started with Daily Mind Medicine, moved to the newsletters, then went to the memo, the courses, bought the book. Now we're going to your event. We're eventually going to be chamber members, and then we'll convince you to take us on as one-on-one clients at some point. So like, talk to us about the concept of moat, and then I have a little bit more questions that I'd like to riff off there.
Okay, cool. So the book is interesting because I actually wrote the book, and it was like 200 plus pages. But then we went through and we're like, what if we turned this into just a manual? We pulled all the stories out, which is like contrarian. You're supposed to like tell stories and have things that are, and you know, I just cut them all out. I was like, when I read a book, sometimes I'll just skip the stories, and I just want to get to like, what's the point of the book? So when we stripped it all out, it brought the page count way down. And I kind of like that. And it's an interesting note that you mentioned that. With the moat concept, I have two thoughts on this. The first is, the world's changing because of content. Like, back in the day, personality-driven businesses didn't really exist. You know, something could be faster, it could be cheaper, it could be more reliable, it could be better. Like, you had these real tangible tactical things. But then, you know, like Elon Musk comes on the scene, and content producers come on the scene, and you have like this extra category, this bonus category that's bolted on. And it's just like the likability or the relatability of the founder. So the more content I can put into the market, the more of a moat I have around like my type of business. So that's the first thing. We have podcasts, events, and books and reports. I'll send you guys some other stuff after this podcast. The second theme of a moat is goodwill in the market. And the unconverted money in the market acts as a moat in and of itself. One of the things Jay Abraham taught me is you want to be able to secure future revenue. And I had never heard of this concept before. He said that there are, I think, three or four types of revenue. There's like psychic revenue. There's in being converted revenues, like Stripe accounts and things like that. But future revenue is the reputational effect you have in your business. So if you have somebody in your market that feeds on your content, they love your content, but they haven't given you money yet for it, that in and of itself is a moat, because it's tremendous goodwill. It's hard to break in. Like, think about somebody like Alex Hormozi, who kind of pioneered a little bit of this, you know, give everything away for free. Like, he's one of the front runners of that. It's really hard to break into a Hormozi fan club. It's real hard to break in and take those people, because they haven't given Hormozi money, but they love Hormozi. And so the allegiance of a social media following, you want to take people from followers to fans. If you can get somebody from a follower to a fan, all of a sudden you have a moat effect, which is an incubator, and it makes it just harder. What's a moat? A moat just protects your competitive advantage. It makes it harder for somebody to break in. So that goodwill concept is really important.
And so for those that are starting out with their brands that need to start making sales, how do you manage the teeter-totter of not eating into all your goodwill too soon?
I think there's no teeter-totter. There's sequence. It's not even a balancing act when you're first starting out. It's just, what do I do first? And you monetize immediately. You do a great job. You do a great service. Even if you're monetizing at a low level, this gets into like... More like psychology principles of self-esteem and confidence. So you have to build all of that. So when I was first starting, I did my first sales package for like $400. And it was like four sales letters and four VSLs and email campaigns for everything. And I made $400 and I thought that I was like king of the world. And now it's like, I can't believe that I gave all of that away for $400, but it kicked off a bit of a spiral for me, an upward spiral where if, I knew if I could make $400, I could probably make 800. And then if I can make 800, I could do 1200. And then you have these flex points where somebody will like get into a new environment and they'll skip from, instead of going from 800 to 1200, they'll go from 800 to 8,000 because the exposure that they have in a new group or with a new mentor, it will supercharge their believability or their certainty. I don't think that it's much of a question of teeter-totter. Monetize first, get really good at selling, get really good at what you're doing, and then you backfill with a moat.
So I was going to ask you right off of that is for agencies, for businesses that are scaling, that are service-based, how do they properly increase their cost to you know, how do they increase their fee? How do they increase what it costs to work with them properly without underpricing, overpricing? Like, how does that balance go over time?
Yeah. So part of this is tactical. So I can give you a tactical and then like a more of a strategic. I'll start with the tactical. Pricing really comes down to what the market's willing to pay for it. So if you have a good enough sales process and a good enough ecosystem, and that ecosystem, by the way, includes case studies, past results, examples and experiences where you've done a great job and people are really happy, then the market will kind of catch on to that. And the pricing of what the market's willing to pay for it, that's a mirror. Mm-hmm. So I think that tactically, if you can do a really good job and slowly, linearly increase your prices as you go, you know, people get raises every year. It's just a natural progress. Like people want a 5% raise, a 10% raise. You do the same thing with your pricing. The strategic thing is when you really dial down into what you actually do, most people, the reason that they can't collect the fees that they want to collect is really a believability issue with themselves. So we deal with this all the time. Like we have these sales clinics that we do weekly, and most of the price objections that come up, it's not coming from the market. It's coming from the founder. And the founder's sort of worried that maybe they're overcharging, and therefore the market's worried they're overcharging. But that would become now an issue of identity and belief. And we can go deeper on that if you want, but that would be the high level answer.
That's great. Completely outside of the box of this topic, but how do you go about saying no to things as you've grown your businesses, as you've exited businesses for large multiples? You know, your perspective has shifted on what your focus is and should be on, obviously, I imagine, over time. But how do you go about, as all these opportunities come your way at your level, how do you go about sifting through opportunities, auditing them, saying no to them? Like, just where are you at with that side of things in your life?
Yeah. Mostly my secret is people. So I was literally this morning, I was on the phone with my chief of staff because I want to start this events company or buy an events company because I'm like, I'm passionate about events. We'll do 18, 19 events with Wealthy Consultant. We'll do a couple of events with the content company. We'll do a couple of events with the sales staffing company. I just love events because it's the fastest way to kind of like force level somebody's belief up is in a room with other people. And my chief of staff, she was kind of like, she doesn't think that the opportunity is exactly in line with where we're going. And so I've got certain people that I can bounce ideas off of, and they're all given permission inside of like my circle to poke holes in things. I think meritocracy comes to play and comes to mind when we talk about this, because me left to my own devices, I'm not going to say no to, like, I'm going to say yes to everything. I got, because if you guys right now were like, hey, we should launch a book together, I'd be like, yo, you guys seem really fun. Let's do it. Like, that would be a blast. But then before you know it, I've got like 19 books I'm writing, a dozen partnerships, and I'm spread so thin that I can't get anything done. My only secret that has been actually effective is kind of giving veto rights to the people that are really close. There's only two or three people right now who can actually veto something. And they use that every once in a while. And it usually will just delay the decision long enough until I can build a better case. Jeff Bezos is a great example of this. When you study Bezos's culture, this is why the writing culture at Amazon existed. You know, for you to bring an idea to Amazon, you had to write a memo about it, prove it in writing. And when you have to do that, like most ideas are self-selected out, because when you sit down to write why you should do it, you're like, yeah, this isn't that actually good of an idea. I'll tell you one more story on this. Tactically, I was telling, her name is Gabrielle. She's my chief of staff. And one time she was just kind of not feeling it. She's like, yeah, this sounds amazing. Like, we could probably make an extra 10 grand a year with this. And I was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Got it. It's not a, okay, cool. We'll table that for now. So people just like, no, here's what we want to do. That doesn't fit. And sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it doesn't.
Sure. And that leads me to think about the concept of market cap in the way that you talk about it in the book, because if you say yes to everything, you're probably reaching your market cap a little too fast. Can you talk a little bit more about that specific concept of like unhealthy scale versus healthy scale and what market cap actually is, as opposed to like the definition in the publicly traded market?
Yeah, totally. This is one of my favorite concepts, because at Traffic and Funnels, when we got into like scale territory, our only like cap was how much money can we spend? That was it. And we got really good at liquidating front-end customers. So when you're like paying $100 to get a $120 customer, the answer for how much money can you spend is like all of it. Yes. Spend everything we have. Like, let's grow as fast as we can. What that did in certain seasons of that business is we would throw so many clients into a system that was engineered to handle 50 clients, you know, in a month. And we would enroll 120 clients in a month. And the dilution effect of what happened with our team created a lack of client results in some cases. Certain messages that should have been responded to in a day took 7 days to respond to. And I just started figuring out that anything that compromises the reputation of the business is a violation of the market cap on that business. So my team right now, like, let's put this in like raw brass tacks, as tactical as we can get. The Wealthy Consultant, we have world-class fulfillment systems, world-class fulfillment teams. I spend a fortune on our client services team. And we can handle about 150 clients at one time. Now, this sounds like a lot, and it is, but we can only handle 10 new clients in a month. So that's our market cap at the moment. If we go over 10, we start diluting the experience in that first 60-day period, which if we can get a client, you know, 10 times what they invested to be in the first 60 days, they're pretty happy. They're going to stay around for a really long time. Anything over 10, we start really stressing our systems. So my limit on this is I will not scale past that line. What I'll do is I'll go re-engineer the system, add more people, change the way that we do things. And it's a constant push against that line. If I can get it to 12, that's our new market cap. If I can get it to 15, that's our new market cap. But right now it's 10, and we honor that. So we don't enroll any more than 10 in a given month.
Dude, you're hitting me deep right now, because this relates big time. Because I sometimes think that the answer to all of our problems is more customer acquisition, which is not the case. Mm-hmm. But would you argue that you have to almost break the market cap to identify the market cap at the same time? Like, how do you identify it if you're not getting towards that capacity?
Yeah, you got to get up there and test it and poke around with it. You know, it's the same thing with, but this is a different, it's easier in our space than it is. Like, we're not manufacturing cars.
Sure.
But even that industry, if you look at it, you know, and I've been a Tesla guy since 2015. I've driven Tesla since 2015. So I was just like, before Elon was Elon, I was studying Elon. And yeah, he's totally guilty of the same thing. We're like, we're gonna ship 1 million cars. And it's like, dude, your factories only work up to 300,000. But it's only in that massive goal where everyone's committed to fixing the bottlenecks. If another good book is The Goal. It's called The Goal, and it's about throughput and operations constraints, the theory of constraints. You do have to go there, but you can't stay there without fixing it. You have to be willing to bring it back down to really fix the issue. I was talking with somebody this morning And he did about $600,000. He's a client last year, 2023, 600K. And he's only keeping about $8,000 a month. And his goal this year was to double it. I said, no, we're not going to double it. We're not going to take a business that has no profit and you're barely surviving. Doubling it, if you don't love a business when it's small, don't make it big. Because you're just going to hate it even more. Let's fix the business first. And how do we do that? We have eight dials that we take clients through. And we just systematically, on a quarterly basis, we go and fix different departments. There's sales, there's finance, there's team and people, there's your offer. There's the events and operations, mental balance. And if any of one of those dials is underneath where it should be, the founder becomes getting constricted. And to nod back to Dan Martell, he's got a beautiful thought on this. An entrepreneur will never scale into pain. And so if you don't fix the issue, what not only are you breaking the reputation of the business, but you're actually creating a lose-lose environment where you don't want to grow the business anymore. And you'll either sell it, you'll plateau it, you'll give it away, like you'll break the business. And so it's really important that you don't spend too much time over your market cap. Bring it back down, fix it, then try it again.
Sure. And you had mentioned before we got into that concept about like paying money to acquire clients and like throwing dollars at client acquisition. Yeah. And it one of the main things that I got from the book was enterprise value is created through diversification of how you acquire customers at the same time. So that's not just dependent on you, which is so cool. Because like most of the time consulting business is real, it's tough to sell because it's all dependent on the founder. For us, this is a selfish question for us because just through the financial side, we collect over a 12-month cycle. And throughout, we also get paid on other verticals. But how can we identify how much we can put into customer acquisition without going broke in the first month before collecting all of our money? Our LTV is probably, it's healthy, it's like above 40, 50 grand, but we're not realizing that until like a 12-month cycle.
Yeah. I'll send you a book on this that we just finished. We're launching it next month. And it's just a model called Revolving Price. There's a big push in the industry right now to go towards like recurring everything. But straight line MRR, which is what you're talking about a little bit, like your LTV might be 50 grand, but you're only collecting 10 up front. And so you have this confusing gray area, like what you're talking about, where if you grow too fast, you go broke. And there's a massive difference between profit and cash as well, depending on how you run your financial statements and how you track your books. I'm a fan of monitoring your marketing efficiency ratio. And I don't necessarily mean that from just a purely, like that's not a ROAS necessarily. It's just like everything I'm putting into the marketing team, anything I'm putting into advertising dollars or content production or media, I want a multiple on that. And I want that multiple to be over one, which means that my acquisition multiple, I need to get it all back in the first month at the very minimum. So products help you do this. If you are spending money on a VSL funnel, you're getting leads, but you're not getting any money. And so you're just going to have a waiting period that you judge acceptable or tolerable. It's like Agora would, you know, when Agora is running their stuff, they'll scale something at a 0.3 liquidation because they know they're going to get it back in 4 or 5 months. I don't typically scale something if it's underneath a one. Does that mean I'm leaving money on the table? Yeah, 100%. But I am incubated. My books are safe. And I know that any scale that I have today is not going to compromise me operationally in 6 months. It means you have to grow slower. And people don't like to do this. But sometimes another point in the book is I'm going to chase the certain path, not the expedient path. When you have that philosophy underlying everything you do, you're willing to slow down on your spend, slow down on your acquisition, so that every piece along the pie is actually not a liability for your business. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Slam dunk. Yeah, that's awesome. As far as money mistakes, you see growing entrepreneurs making, you know, they go from a couple hundred grand of revenue to seven figures, well above, they're growing. What are some money mistakes that if you go back to yourself you made that you'd write the ship on, and some advice you give to young business owners that are starting to see money that they've never seen, their family's never seen, tactically on the business side, and then also maybe even on the personal side, if you don't mind kind of expanding on that.
Yeah, at the very top, you know, like not paying yourself would be a massive issue. That actually breaks the it breaks the cause effect of a founder wanting to grow the business in the first place. So when you see when an entrepreneur who's been in business for like 15 years and they're making the same amount of money, usually there's like a reward system breakage in their business, because it doesn't matter whether they grow or not. And then the flip side of that would be paying yourself too much. So you're cleaning out the accounts every month. Grant Cardone is an example of this. Like, I remember meeting Grant Cardone and he was like, I clean out my accounts at the end of the year, go straight to zero. And I'm like, bro, you're literally insane. Like, you're a crazy person. And so you have no fortress at that point. You got to have enough money in the business. And in a recession, like, that number for me is like, I want like a 12-month runway for the business on fixed expenses. That doesn't include advertising or commissions, but on the fixed payroll and the fixed burn, the offices, things like that. In a bull market, you can bring that all the way down to like 3, because money's easy to get and people are always going to have money. When you have that kind of grid, what are you going to do with that money? What are you going to do with that cash on hand? Team and research and development and optimizing the products. So we spend a really good amount of money on team. Our team is really expensive. They're really good. But that is back to enterprise value. It's pulling the enterprise value of the company away from my brand, and it's putting it into actually the collective operation of the business. So my client services director, my chief of staff, my sales director, all of these people are contributing jointly to the value of the brand. If everybody at Facebook quit tomorrow, the Facebook would not be worth anything, because no one would be there to run it. It doesn't even matter if there are active users on the platform wouldn't work. So at the end of the day, no matter what, it all tracks down to the people running the organization. And founders make the mistake of staying, keeping the concentration risk on them for too long. They're not willing to pay for the right people. So our revenue per head targets on this are anywhere from 300, 400,000. So if we're under 300,000 revenue per head, I feel pretty vulnerable. If we're close to that 300 to 400, then I know we're doing pretty decent. And we're agency world, I would change that to 150 to 250. Your average on the agency side is probably going to be closer to 200, because you have to have more people to do the service. AI is going to change that for sure. New technology is going to change all of that. But the biggest money mistake of all time, not paying yourself or paying yourself too much, sticking to that like 10 to 15% of the revenue of the business. If you're paying yourself 10 to 15%, you are like really motivated to grow the thing, but you should have money left over to invest into the growth of the business through people.
Sure. We're currently getting really proficient in the profit first method, mm-hmm. which definitely talks a lot about that. I want to be very respectful of your time. So I got one last question. Client retention book, when's that coming out? Give us a little teaser if you can.
Yeah, end of February. It's coming out end of February. I just got a text this morning. They're trying to decide the exact date, because we don't want to launch it on a weekend. So we'll do like a launch party. But this is the biggest thing that I pulled from the past 7-8 years, is if you can retain clients, eventually you rock up to a place where you don't need more clients. And it becomes a bit, it's just unstoppable. You have enough users, members, clients, whatever, that if you want to go 6 months just to optimize the machine, just to improve the process, you can do that. The reason that people get trapped and they end up running bad businesses is because they have to take new clients next month just to pay the burn. You do not want to be in this position. So client retention is superior to client acquisition. Somebody asked me on a podcast a couple of months ago, they're like, do you think that the industry will swing back to recognizing client retention? I said, no, I think client acquisition is just sexy. And once that Pandora's box has been opened, like, I don't think it's ever closing. But this book includes all of our models. How do we track CES? There's a client effort score, NPS, QBRs, quarterly business reviews, end of month surveys. Right now inside a chamber, we're doing a challenge. So we have challenges for different months and we focus on different dials during those challenges. How do you do these things that create this community element where people are not only making more money, but they're getting in better shape, their families are healthier, they have more investments, their wealth is growing. All of this is inside of that book with metrics and how we actually run the system behind the scenes. It's a phenomenal book.
I love it. I love it. One last question on my end is AI. Do you mind riffing on AI? Like, how is that going to impact consulting businesses, advisory businesses, any business or agency? Like, how do you see AI, you know, is it replacing us this year, next year, a couple of years from now? Is it enhancing our ability to drive value to the marketplace? It's like, just riff on that for us as we close up, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I think it's an enhancement to the great ones, and it's an existential threat to the not so great ones. So I think, it will replace a lot of the middle tier of the market. The people who, you know, their best ideas come from going through a program and copying it, or from seeing what somebody else is doing and kind of just copying that. I don't think that there's, I think AI is a threat to people who are kind of coasting and they just sort of run a little advisory business, repurposing the lean startup, you know, things like that. You'll be able to put into an AI, like we're working on this right now, where it's like, it's got, you know, 4,000 hours of content from me, and it's me basically. So it can answer questions based on how I answered them on prior calls. What it won't replace though is, you know, are the inventors and the engineers and the people who are really out there tinkering, testing, experimenting. Because the thing about AI, at least right now, is it's not actually coming up with anything new. It's connecting different pieces of content that already exist together. So I don't think it will be a threat to the people at the top. I think it's going to be a massive enhancement. It's going to make us a lot faster.
Well, as long as it could keep the witty tone that you're talking on Facebook, we're all good there.
Let's go. Dude,
thank you so much for taking the time in. We've been looking forward to this for a while. You have impacted our lives in ways you probably don't even understand. So thank you so much, man. And God bless you, brother. Have a great rest of your day.
Hey, thank you. Can't wait to ski here pretty soon.
Yes, sir.